So on slide six, prevention is an activity that, or activities that we do in order to keep illness from occurring. And we have some examples of prevention activities that local health departments do all the time. For example, all the time you're doing immunizations, and those are prevention activities. All the time you do food safety activities. All the time you're doing clean indoor air activities. All those activities are to prevent people from getting ill. Control means that after illness has occurred, we want to keep it from spreading. So we use different, sometimes some of the same tools as we use in prevention, but generally different tools for control. So we might use isolation. We isolate an ill person to keep them from spreading disease to others. Furloughs or quarantines are examples of control measures. We might prophylax or immunize contacts, et cetera. So some types of control measures are listed on the slide. So let's talk about how the law is actually on our side in West Virginia for carrying out all these activities. And that will carry us to slide 8 for those of you that are following along from the slides that came in your email. So the first thing that you need to understand is some definitions. And it's important to understand that everyone who works in the local health department actually works under the legal authority of the local health officer. So who's the health officer? Actually, the legal definition is that you are the health officer because you're acting as the designee of the health officer. So it is the individual who fulfills the duties and responsibilities, et cetera, for a local board of health or his or her designee. So if you're the designee, under the law, you're the health officer. So you probably didn't know that, did you? Good to know. Let's go on to slide 9. So it's great that you're all now local health officers, but you have a lot of responsibilities under the law as the local health officers. So here are some of the things that you're responsible for. In 16.2, you're responsible to annually notify reporting sources of reporting requirements. That means you have to tell your health providers, your facilities, your laboratories, veterinarians, animal control officers, all these people, you need to go tell what they have, what they're supposed to report. Because, let's think about it, how else are they going to know? So that is one of your responsibilities. Slide 10. You're also supposed to maintain records of all your investigation activities. And there's a partial quotation of the rule, that's 16.3. And not only do you maintain those records, but you hand them off to your successor. So you're responsible for setting the next guy up to succeed because they have all the records of all the great things that you did. Slide 11. You are also responsible to investigate source of disease, identify contacts, look for undetected cases, et cetera, and implement prevention and control methods. So there's that prevention and control. You have the legal responsibility, but good news, also the legal authority to do all those things. And you have the West Virginia Reportable Disease Manual, which is referenced in the rule, to help you. And so that is actually something that is on our side that because it's referenced in the reportable disease rule, it gives that manual the weight of law, and then you are empowered to implement anything that is in the reportable disease protocol manual. So that's pretty cool. All right. Slide 12, you're responsible for reporting any disease or condition listed in the rule within the time frame specified. And you also have slide 13, the responsibility to investigate if someone doesn't report something to you. So 16.7 says if somebody, a healthcare provider, et cetera, fails to report a reportable disease, then you shall notify them and request an explanation, and then 16.8 is then report onto the commissioner, and that would be us because we're the legal designee of the commissioner, the reason for failure to comply. So with that understanding of the very strong legal basis that you have to support your activities, I am now going to hand this over to Dr. Maria Del Rosario, who will drill down in more depth on surveillance activities for local health. And
good afternoon. My name is Maria Del Rosario, and I am the surveillance director for the Division of Infectious Disease Epidemiology. Moving on to the next slide. So this section of the presentation, I will actually be talking about disease reporting in a little bit more detail. I will be talking about the different categories and the methods of reporting. And those methods can encompass the WDS, or the West Virginia Electronic Disease Surveillance System, or the use of electronic lab reporting. I will also be talking about the different resources that are currently available, and these are very helpful resources that will aid in the disease investigation, such as the protocols, the quick surveillance guides, and I will show you where on our website you can find most of these resources. And I will show you also the type of data that we collect, we summarize, and how we analyze them. And that information will be found under the section of surveillance data and indicator data. So for the next slide, as you can see here, you see a nice table, a colored table, that actually summarizes the reportable infectious disease rules. So the table lists the reportable infectious disease conditions, and it is color-coded according to the timing of reporting. If you can see, the first column is the red column, which represents a Category 1, which means all these conditions under this column are immediately notifiable. What this means is if a healthcare provider diagnoses a condition, they need to immediately report it to the local health department. For the orange category, which is Category 2, that needs to be reported within 24 hours. For the yellow column, that's the 72-hour reporting, that's Category 3. And for the green and blue, that means the healthcare provider needs to report it to the health department within a week. So the next slide, I'm actually going to focus a little bit more on the Category 1 and 2. As I mentioned earlier, for Category 1, the healthcare provider needs to immediately notify the health department. For Category 2, again, the healthcare provider needs to notify the health department within 24 hours. And so to address that immediacy of reporting, it is important that the healthcare provider calls the health department and then eventually follow this reporting with a written report. So what does this mean for the health department? Which means that they need to have somebody ready to answer those calls in case a healthcare provider or a laboratory calls you and says, I have this disease and I need to report it to you. Again, this means that the health department should always have somebody ready to answer those calls 24/7, 365. And as you can see for the 72-hour and one-week reporting, you don't need to have a telephone call, but it's imperative that the local health department also needs to be informed on time. Moving to the next slide, here you see the pathway of these investigations, surveillance, and feedback. And I created this pathway because I'm hoping it would sort of clarify some of the things that I will be talking about later. So what happens is we start out with an individual who has a particular disease. And this individual, you see the person in a red box who's sick, this individual goes to his physician, and the physician performs a clinical evaluation and also laboratory testing, and maybe even eventually end up in the hospital. So these are all individuals or groups that need to report the information to our, according to our rule, to our system, which is WDN. So if a sick person shows up at the physician's office, then gets to the hospital, all of these entities need to report. Where do they report to? To the local health department or to us. So on the green box that you can see, which is local health department, you can see that the local health department actually plays a huge role. The local health department investigates this report. They also follow up, and most importantly, they act on it, whether they do prevention recommendations or they offer treatment recommendations or an advice. All this information is put into our electronic disease surveillance system, which is WVS. Now, you see that there's an arrow that goes directly from the blue box to the purple box. What that means is that occasionally, and in currently actually, we have a few laboratories that report electronically to WVS, which means that you're not expected to get a paper report anymore, because any lab reports that detect a reportable infectious disease, these reports automatically get sent to our electronic disease surveillance system. And so that's why we have this arrow that goes directly from the blue to the purple. Now you see there's a two-way arrow that goes between local health and DIDE, and this means that these two entities actually help each other out or support each other or share information. Now, much of my talk today will actually tell you about the black oval section at the bottom, which is surveillance summary and surveillance indicator evaluation. So what this means is all the information that's collected by WVS is later summarized and then shared back with all those people that give us the information. In addition, we also look at the information to see how well it is. Is it complete? Is it timely? Is this information actually usable? This is where surveillance indicator evaluation comes in. And it's important for us to share this with you because much of this information tells you what diseases are common in your area. If you have a school nurse or somebody from your community asking, how common is disease A? The information that we post on our website can actually be very helpful to you. It also guides you for your policy making as well as makes you an informed decision whether you should allocate your resources to a particular disease or a particular type of action. So I'm moving on to the next slide. As I mentioned earlier, we already received electronic lab reporting from a few laboratories. One of them is LabCorp. Some of you might have heard of it. So we do receive that. However, we have many laboratories that still do not send us electronic lab reporting. So what does that mean? What it means is we're still getting paper reports. Let me go back quickly to ELR. For those laboratories that send us reports electronically, we do not send paper reports to your local health department anymore. Every once in a while, we get questions from local health department asking why they do not get faxes of this lab report. That is because those reports are already in our system. So again, please remind your nurses that for electronic lab reports, they should not expect a paper report to be faxed to them. So how supposed to know what reports come in? This is in WVS, and I've highlighted that section in WVS. It says open investigation. Electronic laboratory reports that come into our system are looked at by our surveillance nurse or one of our staff, and they make the determination where this particular lab report goes to. They either call the laboratory or the healthcare provider, or it's even stated in the lab report. But they are the ones to look at it quickly and decide, should this lab report go to Health Department A or Health Department B? And it is at this point that your health department will look at the open investigations, because if it's assigned to your health department, then they will see it on the list. Again, I've highlighted that box under open investigations. This is how health departments would know which investigations they need to look into. Another box that I've highlighted is the rejected notifications. That means if the investigation that they perform is either incomplete or there might be some errors, their investigations are sent back to them. So they need to pay attention to that. Next slide. So where can a local health department staff get all this information? The disease protocol manual, which is found on our website for specific disease, and here you have the example from measles, has a wealth of information for both providers, for the laboratories, and for public health. It pretty much tells you what you need to do. It also informs you about the particular disease, the clinical presentation, and it even tells you about the agent that's giving you the illness. It tells you how long the person can be infectious, and more importantly, it provides guidance on how to prevent and how to treat the particular individual. So this is something that we always encourage local health departments to look at or to read when they are coming across with a particular case. When a healthcare provider asks them about how to manage a particular individual or the family, this would be a very good resource for local health. So moving on to the next slide. This is slide 21 or 22. So in addition, what else is available? So if you go to our website, which is the DID.wv.gov, if you click on surveillance data, which is the one, the arrow with the number one, you click on it, and then you click on number two, which is evaluation, and then you see it open up to a section that says surveillance data evaluation. I would like for local health to view the quick surveillance guide, which is number three. And so why is this important? This guide has a wealth of information, particularly for local health staff who conduct disease investigations and surveillance. This particular guide actually came out last month when our epidemiologist distributed the ring-bound guide to many of the health departments during the Public Health Association meeting. This guide offers techniques and tools to obtain patient information, including a letter for healthcare providers that exempt public health from HIPAA. Also, this guide lists the different surveillance indicators for disease program areas under which each disease will be examined later on. So I encourage you to please remind your local health staff to dust off the surveillance guide if they put it away. Going to the next slide. So now that you have all these resources, you'd probably be interested in knowing where does DID put their data. Well, everything is on our website. If you click on surveillance data once again, which is the number one, then click on, let's go with the weekly report. The weekly report is a summary of all the conditions that have been investigated and closed up to the week. So this is a year-to-date, and this is for the entire state of West Virginia. This is a very nice page because it's fairly interactive. You can scroll down and you can see the number of cases reported for the state for a particular illness. Okay, moving on to the next page. You can see the annual report, and this is very nice because I'm going to move on to the next slide. Here, in this is slide 26, you can actually see the number of conditions reported by counties. So if you want to know how many cases of hepatitis do I have from my county, this is the one web page that you might want to go. Sometimes you get questions from your legislatures, sometimes from the school nurses, sometimes from the media. This is very, very helpful. Next slide. So the next question that you get is, so why is Maria telling me all this? Well, here's the question. If you look at your surveillance data, the slide before, which is slide 26, you're going to wonder, okay, so I have 10 cases of hepatitis A in my county. But here's my question. How good is that information? Do you actually have all the necessary information to say yes, I do indeed have 10 cases of hepatitis A? We won't know for sure until we conduct a surveillance evaluation. And that brings you to slide 27. So what is or what are surveillance indicators? Surveillance indicators shows how well we investigate cases and conduct surveillance. And this measures completeness of information and the timeliness of information, the timeliness of notification, and the timeliness of our response to the public. So let's move on to the next slide. So early this year, we summarized, or we actually looked at the 2014 surveillance data. And we wanted to see how well our data was. And our objective was really, number one, we wanted to share it with you and our stakeholders, and we also wanted to improve the type of data quality that we have. We also wanted to identify areas that we can improve on, and most importantly, this was actually a requirement of funding for us. The CDC was looking for results of this. So how did we do? So on the next slide, which is slide 29, we collected disease areas. We have the vaccine-preventable disease. We have the hepatitis, the viral hepatitis. We have foodborne, and we have the zoonotic disease. For this particular disease group, we looked at how complete the data was. We also looked at how well and how timely these conditions were reported to public health and the types of actions that needed to happen for this particular condition. So let's move on to slide 30. When I say completeness, we look at the completeness of specific demographic information. Next slide. When I said timeliness, we actually looked at three time frames. Number one is how soon from the time that these cases were identified to the time that they were reported to WBS. This is a requirement of the rule. Remember that notification, this is part of that. Next is the reporting time to CDC. This is the one measure that CDC will examine. How soon do we report it to them? And the third important measure is the public health action. This is very important because certain conditions, we have to act fairly quickly to be able to control the spread of disease. Next slide, 32. So when I mentioned earlier the timeliness and completeness of data, I would like to let you know that each disease group actually has their own specific measures. For instance, for hepatitis, it looks at specific fields. For instance, for hepatitis B, it looks at the proportion of cases, acute cases with complete information, or the proportion of acute cases with complete vaccination history. So as you can see, there are specific things that we look at for specific diseases, but there are also measures that we look at for all in general. So all this information is found in the quick surveillance guide that I mentioned earlier. Moving on to slide 33. So how did we do? On slide 33, you have a snapshot. Some of you might not be able to see it clearly, but here is just a small snapshot of what the surveillance indicator looks like for salmonella and what the surveillance indicators look like for hepatitis B. On top of this page is the website that I would encourage all of you to go so you can look at it closely. But this tells you that out of the X number of salmonella cases, how many of these cases actually had complete information? How many of these cases ended up being hospitalized? How many of these cases ended up being dead? It would be very helpful and actually be very informative to you if you view this. You might want to see how you fare compared to the rest of the counties in your region and share this with the people that actually conduct the investigation. Moving to the next slide. Now, this is something that some of you may have seen before, but I think it's not really something that's new. We have shared this with the regional EPI, but this is the local health department program plan. Some of you who review the program plan on a yearly basis probably might find some of the indicators quite familiar, but it's really nothing new to what you normally what we would normally look at every year, other than we tease out some of those indicators. What these indicators mean or what they represent is pretty much what I showed earlier. So on the top part, which is the salmon-colored indicator, it actually evaluates general surveillance, general infectious disease surveillance, such as how many of your investigations were lost to follow-up, how many were complete, how many had completed risk factor data, how many had completed vaccine information, and how many were submitted within the time frame, which is 30 days. Now, the green section highlights indicators for outbreak. Again, this should not be something that's new to the health department. The one thing that we added here is the proportion of outbreaks that had respiratory and foodborne specimens collected. I'd like for you to take note of that. And then the bottom pink one, which is influenza, again, this should not be new. And I would like to reiterate that this is these are measures that we've measured previously. This is not new. I just want you to be aware that this is what how we're looking at the data. So now that we have shared with you how we look at the data, this is actually how the data looks like. So early this year, we summarized the 2014 surveillance data that we had collected. And what we did is we combined all the conditions, we combined the demographic data, and we wanted to see how each health department performed. And I know it's not so clear here because it's small, but I would encourage you to please look at it to see where you stand. We would like to use the 2014 as our baseline data, but we will be working with each of the health departments to see what we can do to improve some of these measures. Again, I would encourage you to look at this. So, and I think with that, I end my section for surveillance, and I'll give you back to Dr. Pickles.
Thank you very much. We are now going to fast forward to talk about outbreak investigation. I'm doing this segment on behalf of Dr. Sharif Ibrahim, who is currently out of town and will be back early next month. So let's talk about outbreak investigation. We are now on slide 36. And again, when it comes to outbreak investigation, the law is on your side. You have very strong authority, but also very important responsibilities. And some of those are listed here. First is that outbreaks are immediately reportable to you, 7.1, regardless of setting, whether it's healthcare, daycare, whatever, it's reportable to you immediately. 7.2, if you then are required to report to us immediately. 7.3, you're required to collaborate with all appropriate parties in the investigation, but of course, all appropriate parties also are required to collaborate with you. So 7.3 is a very nice provision. Next slide, slide 37. The rule also outlines your authority to do epidemiological studies, 7.5, laboratory studies, 7.6, and it gives you, there are very strong confidentiality provisions, which allows you to protect the identity of somebody that's involved in an outbreak. So that's really good because people are much more comfortable opening up about what's going on if they know that their confidentiality is protected. Let's see. We are now on slide 38. Slide 38 outlines some very helpful provisions in the rule because sometimes when you're doing a healthcare investigation, especially, you come up on this problem of if and when do you engage the regulators, which is OFLAC or licensing boards. And that's a very difficult issue. The law, the reportable disease rule in 7.8 gives a very clear wall that I think that I find very helpful in terms of investigations. We are required to report to regulators if there's an ongoing risk to public health and the entity under investigation fails to take corrective action. So that's really nice to know because there are times when you actually need to, when people actually do that and you need to engage regulators, and it's really useful to have that spelled out in the rule. And then 7.9 is also really helpful because it lays out a requirement that if we are in the process of doing an investigation and we discover that somebody may have been exposed to hepatitis or HIV, that we have a legal obligation to notify them, and then we can break confidentiality under those provisions. So, again, I think the rule is actually, for the most part, really helpful and very much on your side. All right, slide 39. So, again, your investigation protocol is also a document that has a basis within the rule, and this is the address to look this up if you want to look up what our general outbreak investigation guidelines are. And so there's the web address on slide 39. What I think we use a lot more often are our outbreak toolkits. And these are short, one- or two-page guides for some, and this is, again, on slide 40, and you have the address to pull these off the website. These are short, one- or two-page guides that are ready to go if you get an influenza outbreak or an outbreak of gastroenteritis in a nursing home or some of the more common outbreaks, sort of the bread-and-butter outbreaks, if you will, that we get all the time. And if you're maybe doing an outbreak investigation for the first time or the second time and you're really a little shaky on exactly what you're supposed to do, these toolkits are designed for you to kind of get your feet under you really fast and have everything at your fingertips to guide you through the first few times that you do one of these. And we do find that our local health departments use these all the time. And they also have outbreak report templates that our local health departments use a lot. So that's the web address for those toolkits. So what's going on with outbreaks in West Virginia? Well, I have to admit in slide 41 that this is great. We actually have had a huge increase in the number of outbreaks that have been reported in the last decade plus. You can see that we used to have just a handful reported statewide every year back in the early 2000s, and now we get close to 200 reported every year. And that's, why is that? It's due to lots of things. But the entire public health system really collaborated to make these changes. There were a lot of changes at state health departments, a lot of changes. We have more regional EPIs now than we had back in 2001. We have the threat preparedness funding that came in. We have ELC funding that came in, and probably also state funding for local health. So the entire system really, I think, benefited from a lot of different infrastructure building activities that have occurred in the last decade plus. So that's kind of a nice slide. And let's go on to slide 42. If you're having problems, you should have a copy of your slide in an email.
Yes.
Yeah, everybody should have gotten copies of the slides in their email, and hopefully you're at least on the phone with a copy of slides from your email and can follow along that way. I think we are definitely, I'm seeing that we're having some technical difficulties still with the live meeting, and I'm sorry about that, but definitely the slides are available in your email. All right, Rhea talked about data, and there also is a lot of data on the outbreak website. This is actually not up there yet because it's 2014 data, which is still under review. And but when that is released, it will be posted to the website. You can certainly find the 2013 report there, but this is 2014 data. The reason I wanted to show this slide is just to point out that there's a lot outbreaks that happen, especially in long-term care facilities, enteric outbreaks of gastroenteritis, respiratory outbreaks. These are really, if you've never done an outbreak investigation before or you feel unfamiliar, it won't probably be too long before you'll have one of these in your county. And it's a really good way to learn how to do an outbreak investigation. And it's a really good way to get to know your long-term care facilities and people in your healthcare community, because when something like that's going on and you have some of the answers they need, then they start to look on you as somebody that can be really helpful to them when they need help. And so you know, definitely forge ahead with an outbreak toolkit and get some experience looking at these. A lot of health departments have done that over the years, and you can look and see what your outbreak performance measures are on this handy little one-pager that Maria put together. Maria actually, if you look at on the website that's listed on this slide, you can pull this up and you can look at your surveillance indicators, and you can also look at your outbreak indicators, which are indicated in the orange arrows. I actually think our local health departments are doing pretty darn well on a lot of your outbreak indicators, partly because we've been feeding them back and calling attention to it for a number of years, and I think they're I'm pretty impressed by and large. But you can look and see for yourself how you're doing in terms of timeliness of reporting, whether or not you get your outbreak reports in, and hopefully you're sharing those outbreak reports with the facilities that had the outbreak and not just with us, because it is supposed to be a communication tool to talk to people about the work that you're doing and how you're supporting your community. But yeah, have a look at that. That's a very important document that Maria put together. So let's forge quickly forward to what does all this mean for an administrator, because there are some very substantial things that that you have responsibility for. First and foremost is making sure that you have a responsible, trained individual to do epi work, because epi work can happen any time of, unfortunately, any time of the night or day and any day of the week. And so having somebody that really knows what to do and that's available is really important. So making sure that you assign a staff person to primary responsibility and backup. We're all human. No person can be available 365 days out of the year, so that backup is really important. This person, you need to assign responsibility for disease investigation, for outbreak team, for outreaching to your providers and labs about what they're supposed to be reporting, and you need to figure out somehow how you're going to staff 24/7, 365 on-call responsibilities, because that's a tough one. We struggle with that as well. You also, item number two on slide 45, need to know when and how to call for reinforcements. Your regional epidemiologist should be there for you. We also try to be available, and we are available 24/7, 365. When you go home when you're on call, you sleep with a darn on-call next to your bedside. So that's how we do that. All right. Here's a map of your regional epidemiologist, and that is available on our website. And hopefully everybody knows who their regional epidemiologist is and knows how to get in touch with them. Other things that you should really be thinking about are training and support. Obviously, infectious disease changes all the time, and there is a constant need for people to update their knowledge and know what's going on and learn new things. And so you actually have to budget time and money for that. You have to budget mileage. You have to budget protected time and expenses for training. Other support that people need is phone, fax, email, internet access, printing expenses, because they sometimes need to print out information sheets for providers or labs or patients. You also need to keep in mind the importance of laboratory support. Most lab supplies are supplied through charge by OLS, but you actually need to stock them. You need to have them available. So somebody needs to take responsibility for making sure that you've got unexpired collection kits available at all times, because you never know when you're going to get one of those outbreaks and you're going to need to respond. And you also need to reserve funding for shipping, because you can collect a stool specimen, but it doesn't walk itself to OLS. You have to figure out how to get it there, and unfortunately, like so many things, that costs actual money. The other thing that you should really think about is we do have some upcoming trainings. I am excited about the Public Health Symposium because this year there will be the best outbreak competition, and all six regions will be vying for the much coveted award for the best outbreak, and I don't think you want to miss this because you're going to hear six really of the more interesting and complicated outbreaks that people have dealt with in the last year and how they approached it. And you can really learn a lot from hearing how other people have responded to outbreaks. In fact, that is probably as good a teacher as doing it yourself, which is a really good teacher. We are very shortly going to break out some hepatitis regional training throughout the state, latter part of this year and early 2016. Next year we are trying to do some regional foodborne outbreak trainings. There will be some Lyme disease training in selected areas, and we are working on doing a VPD training. So 2016 looks to be a very busy year for training, and I hope that you will be enjoying joining us for some of those trainings. That concludes our remarks. I am, again, very grateful that you spent this hour with us. We apologize for the technical difficulties. You should have a copy of the slides in your email. If you missed a few things, hopefully you can kind of go back through and figure out. We at least, I think, have websites for most of these things, so you can look them up yourself. Please do that, because there's a lot of information on the website about surveillance and outbreaks, and especially your evaluation data, I think is really important to be familiar with. Again, thank you so much for spending an hour with us. We are very grateful that you chose to do that. Okay, thank you all, and again, I do apologize for any technical difficulties. Ask people to send questions to our email. We did not have any, so at this time, is there anyone on the phone that has any questions?